We are the Bros Who Think Media Network, and you're listening to our sports show, Prime Time. Hey! The Saints are coming.
The Saints are coming. What's up, guys? Welcome to Prime Time, episode 12.5. We're joined by a special guest this week as Brian from NOLA East joins us. Brian, how you doing today?
Doing just fine, guys. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Long time coming. I'm glad to be on.
Yeah, no problem. We're excited to have you on. Look, there's a big week this week because minicamp starts. And so I figured we'd start out with that and then maybe get into a little basketball talk to finish it off. But to start out with minicamp, you know, we kind of talked before the episode started and you know, I kind of talked about it a little bit. But what are you looking forward to being able to see for these upcoming 3 days?
I definitely want to check out the progression that the guys are making, and that's going to be guys like Marcus Davenport, even Marshawn Lattimore, some of the rookies that they brought in, like a Cameron Moore, and of course, I definitely want to check on what happens at that running back spot, and just kind of see how guys progress from day to day. Last time, you know, around this time for minicamp and OTAs, you got a chance to see Marshawn Lattimore emerge, if you will. He came out that very first practice, had a really rough go at it. And from the next point on, the Saints kind of look like they forced him to kind of go one-on-one with Michael Thomas. As we can see from both guys, it looks like it paid off very well. And I kind of want to see that progression from day to day, especially if Marcus Davenport can kind of improve each day. I think that's a good sign for the Saints defensive line if he can.
Yeah, you know, you're going to be looking for a lot of improvement from those young guys. And I know you got to see a couple of practices whenever they were doing OTAs. And it's not as much, I guess, as you get in minicamp. So to talk about the difference in this phase of the offseason, what are they going to be doing in minicamp itself?
I think this time around, especially because they'll have the fans there and they kind of want to put on a little bit of a show, we'll see more team activity than we probably have over the past couple of times at OTAs. Usually OTA is kind of that third day of install. They put a little bit of team in, but they work on things that they kind of want to correct more or less in front of the media versus kind of having minicamp when you get to see a little bit of everything. So they'll just keep progressing day by day, I guess, almost as if it's a full install. And I guess more or less recall to see what guys really remember from the classroom to the field. And I'm kind of just excited to see what the guys do in front of the crowd and whether or not that'll hype them up to where they come out and battle just a little bit more, or if it's going to be just, you know, the kind of what we've seen thus far, kind of laid back practices, but, you know, an explosive play here and there.
Yeah, and something that I'm going to be looking forward to is watching this defensive backfield. You saw last year it was kind of an emergence year for the DBs to step up after years of bad DB play. And it looks pretty crowded in the backfield this year. For the cornerback position specifically, though, you saw guys like King Crawley step up last year. Is there a King Crawley that's on this roster right now?
Wow, that's a really good question, and I'm not sure if there's going to be anybody like a Ken Crawley simply because from year one to year two, I think the biggest adjustment for Ken Crawley was just the idea that he was always in position year one. He just never seemed to be able to actually complete the play. So I'm not sure if there's going to be a guy like that, especially based on what we saw last year from the guys, because they all seem to be game ready from day one. I think if there's a dark horse to kind of maybe get a lot more playing time than what we thought, it'd be Cameron Moore, simply because he's getting that Marcus Williams treatment. He's kind of a guy that's going to be Marcus Williams' backup. And it's weird to see because he was a corner in college, and now he's being moved over to free safety. But the coaches obviously trust him because he's back there by himself most of the time, kind of being a lot like what we saw Marcus Williams there. His acceleration and his grasp of the defense just seems to be a lot higher than most. I'm very interested to see what he does over this minicamp session, and maybe he could be Ken Crawley-like in that he can make that jump immediately instead of year one to year two, just maybe come right out and make it like we see the rookies do last year.
Do you have any thoughts on Arthur Millette and him being able to make a jump, or do you think this may be his last year with the team?
I think it's going to be difficult for him, not because he doesn't make plays, but because there are so many guys that are going to be battling for positions right now. The back in the secondary right now, it's not just the cornerbacks battling with the corners. It's the cornerbacks also battling with safeties because they have so much depth back there. And I think you guys will get a chance to check that out when you come over the week for minicamp. There's a lot of depth. And we're talking about maybe four, five, six guys that are fighting for certain spots because the slot corner, for example, has Patrick Robinson there. But as we know, we're speaking of Arthur Millette. We're speaking of a guy like like P.J. Williams and even, you know, the rookie that they drafted, Natrell Jameson. Those are three corners that are fighting for that spot. And that's not even counting the safeties that could actually fill in that void as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see the cuts when they come down to for the Saints and who's able to emerge via preseason and training camp. It's going to be exciting to see who makes this team. And if they do, we know the Saints have a good 53 if they make it.
Yeah, and you look at this 53, and it's almost just, you know, adding one or two people at a certain position to improving the overall position group. And a position that I'm looking at is linebacker. You get a guy like DeMario Davis coming in, who had arguably one of his best, if not his best year last year with the Jets. You get a healthy A.J. Klein, and your unit starts to get healthy. You know, last year you saw Alex Anzalone get a lot of play at the beginning of the year before he got hurt. Is Alex Anzalone someone that you're looking to start at that weak side position, or is that maybe more of a Craig Robertson spot right now?
I think if I had to judge who would get the nod as of right now, I would say Anzalone has that edge, and Craig Robertson will kind of be like a backup. Surprisingly, what's been going on thus far in OTAs is DeMario Davis has been playing a lot of weak side linebacker, and I didn't see that coming when he was signed. And I'm kind of a little surprised by that move. Now, I know Sean Payton came out, and he said that, you know, as training camp emerges, that, you know, more or less you'll see how the linebacker spot shakes out. But guys have been pretty much all over the place, and they look like they're experimenting with guys in every role. Because A.J. Klein has yet to come back, and I think he'll be the starting strong side linebacker, you're seeing guys kind of maybe the Saints playing a little more nickel, or you're having guys like maybe like Anzalone playing more strong side linebacker, and DeMario Davis will play weak. But it's been really interesting with the linebackers right now. I really can't say who's going to be where, but I do know if I had to get a nod right now, it's Anzalone's to lose, if you will.
It's going to be interesting to see, because especially those guys, like you said, DeMario Davis, A.J. Klein, you can move those guys around a lot. And I'm really intrigued to see where training camp, where those guys end up lining up as you get into the season. Now, another position on the defense before we move over to the offensive side of the ball that I'm intrigued to hear your opinion on is defensive tackle. I see Sheldon Rankins is a guy that I expect to have a really big year this year. You know, Onyemata continues to improve along with Tyler Davidson. But you know, behind that, it seems like we're a little thin, you know, one or two injuries away from having an issue up the middle. So for defensive tackle, who are some guys that we should be looking at? Maybe some of the defensive ends moving over to DT that we can be looking towards making an impact on this defensive front.
I think you hit, I mean, just the nail on the head with that when you were spot on in the idea that it seems to be, if there's a weak link on the Saints defense, it is defensive tackle. Now, I know last year they were really high on Mitchell Lavin, and he kind of was one of those cuts that they kind of regretted making, but he's a guy that can play defensive end and defensive tackle. Outside of him, there's Mundo and there's Stalwart, two rookie undrafted free agents that were signed on. But I wouldn't expect too much from those guys, only because they're going to be a part of a rotation if they can even make it. What I think we'll see happen is, I think after training camp, if there are any veterans cut, I think that's where the Saints will try to fill in that final defensive tackle spot. I can only see four making the team simply because the Saints seem to be so deep at defensive end, and I don't think they're going to want to get rid of that part of it. Nick Underhill, and we all, you know, follow the Saints, you have to know who Nick Underhill is at this point, writer for the New Orleans Advocate. He came out this week and said that, you know, the Saints kind of want to mimic what the Philadelphia Eagles are doing as far as being eight deep on defensive line. I could see that happening, especially with the Saints NASCAR package, and once they shift those defensive ends inside. So I think they'll only keep four D tackles for that purpose and keep more defensive ends just so they can have that package and have those guys fresh.
Yeah, maybe this could be a year where Cam Jordan doesn't have to play 99% of the defensive snaps. I can only imagine that would get him a little more fresh, you know, for the fourth quarter, right?
Oh, no question about that. I mean, even last year in the Minnesota game, you know, I think had the Saints been able to keep an Alex Okafor healthy, I think that would have made a huge difference for Cam, because you could see at the end of that game, he was gassed. I mean, his pass rush was there, but he just didn't have enough to get to the quarterback at that point. And maybe, just maybe, oh gosh, they don't have those final 10 seconds in order to complete that play. And it's a different story for the Saints, who could have possibly went on to Philadelphia and won that game. So I think if Cam can get just a little help on the opposite side, it's definitely going to help him, especially if he can get a breather in the meantime.
Yeah, that would help a lot, especially in that game you talked about. I agree, you know, Cam was right there, and maybe an extra rest towards the end of the game, and he makes that play. But let's go over to the other side of the ball and let's look at the offensive line. A unit last year that saw a lot of injuries, a lot of guys going in and out. You saw the usual from Armstead not being able to play a full season, but you lost, I think, one of your biggest contributors last year in Kelemente. They did add a guy like Bushrod, but besides that, you know, it seems like they have a good group of guys behind your starting five, but a lot of guys that seem like they're in this, you know, kind of even with each other. What guys do you think are going to be able to make an impact behind your starting five?
Well, hopefully, and you know, fingers crossed when we say this, there's no need for us to even find out the answer to that question, because if the guys can remain healthy, they're one of the best offensive lines in football, especially the guy you named in particular, Teron Armstead. I think his ability to be on the field can go a long way. He's one of the most athletic tackles in football. And at the left tackle spot, you really don't want to keep seeing that shift take place of having Andres Pete possibly have to move over to tackle instead of being at guard, or even having a Bushrod have to slot in his place instead. Now, I do know there's a backup that they brought in, Michael Ola. He looked pretty good during camp thus far in OTAs. So he looks pretty decent thus far. A veteran tryout that they got. He was a former Detroit Lion. Looks pretty decent thus far. He looks like he'll be the main candidate, maybe even Bushrod, kind of, you know, because he's so versatile. And that's what the Saints look like they have this year. More versatile guys that can play multiple positions, but let's hope we don't ever have to find out. Now, as far as behind those guys, we know the usual suspects. It's going to be a guy like Bushrod. Will Clapp, that's a guy who I think is going to, you know, take a ton of snaps if there's ever a package for him, maybe that jumbo package that the Saints like to run. So I think he's a guy that's going to see some snaps if they need him. But again, let's all hope that the starting O-line stays intact and you know, they're able to kind of make headway with that. We don't want to see the musical chairs start again. And last year, the Saints had 21 guys go on IR. I don't want to see that ever happen again.
Yeah, the injury bug is something that bit this team hard last year, yet they still had a good season. So I'm hoping for a good, you know, good graces from the injury gods, whoever that is, whoever we should be praying for. Saints fans, you should be praying now and throughout the season. Because going into another position that I want to talk about, and that's tight end. You saw the third down numbers last year were out of whack. Didn't make sense with an offense that was, you know, one of the best in the NFL to have such a bad third down conversion percentage. It didn't make sense, but I think bringing in a tight end like Ben Watson can help with that third down, those third down issues. What do you think we can see from Ben Watson? Does he come back and have the same type of form that he had last time he was with the Saints?
I actually think it's going to be better, but it may not look like that on the stat sheet, if you will. I think he's going to be a much of an improvement over what they've had lately. Let's be honest, Michael Huamananui and Josh Hill, both on one-year deals, by the way, and this, you know, looks like it could be their last year. They don't really have the juice that you need in order to kind of strike fear in the defense or even be able to at least give you some type of threat when it comes to being out there. Blocking, they're adequate, but not necessarily great in that either. So when you look at those guys, you already know Ben Watson's going to be an improvement over both. And Ben doesn't have to be, you know, a 34-year-old Ben Watson anymore, because I don't think the Saints offense is going to dictate that he has to be that. He just has to be good enough. Be good enough to get open on third downs, be good enough to get open in the red zone, and that's just fine, because with the weapons that the Saints have on the outside, that's going to be a difference. And coming out of the backfield, you still have guys like Alvin Kamara, Mark Ingram once he returns, and then, of course, the new addition in Boston Scott, who looks to be a guy that can kind of, you know, kind of fill that Alvin Kamara role, maybe even a blend between the two. I just think with so many weapons on the field, Ben Watson doesn't have to be great, just be adequate.
Yeah, be a guy that can catch the ball over the middle, work the short yardage situations. And they added a guy in Cameron Meredith, too. So let's talk about receiver. You know, the receiving core before we added Meredith, before we got Traquan Smith, looked a little shaky. You know, you're a Michael Thomas ankle injury away from being one of the worst units, in my opinion, in the NFL. Even with Drew Brees, you know, Drew Brees has the ability to lift guys up to levels that other quarterbacks can't. But now this receiver core is looking a lot deeper. It's looking better. And I heard a lot of news about Trayvon Darrow looking a lot better. So who are some guys outside of the top three of Ginn, Thomas, and Meredith that we should be looking to, you know, make the team and take some spots from maybe a guy like Tommy Lou Lewis or even a Brandon Coleman?
I think that's going to be the trick. At this point, we already know who I believe is are the top four wide receivers, and that's going to be Mike Thomas, Meredith, Ted Ginn, and possibly Tre'Quan Smith, simply because I think they're not going to give up on him so easily. However, that fifth wide receiver and sixth wide receiver spot, those are the dogfights. I know Sean Payton has said repeatedly that he likes Brandon Coleman. He has a vision and a role for him specifically, and that's probably going to be a blocking wide receiver. But Trayvon Doral has been making play after play after play every time I've seen him, especially coming off last year OTAs. He looked pretty good. He looked like he was going to have a really decent preseason at least. And then all of a sudden, Garrett Grayson overthrows him. He gets basically decapitated, and that's the end of Trayvon Doral's career as far as year number one. This time, he's come out. It looks like he's put on a little bit more weight. He's still just as fast. You know, and, of course, at LSU, we never really know what these receivers can do because they don't have great quarterback play. Well, recently, he's been in with the ones getting a lot of reps, and he looks really, really good, especially when Drew Brees is throwing him the ball. He looks like he can get open, he finds the zones, and he can get downfield. Brandon Coleman is going to be Brandon Coleman. We already know what he is. He's a 6'6 guy that sometimes plays like he's 6'1, and the only time we ever see him get physical is when he's blocking downfield. Tommy Lee Lewis, we know exactly what we have in him. He's a dynamo, little small guy, kind of maybe a special teams guy, but unfortunately for him, you know, it's going to be tough because there are other guys that are fighting for spots. Austin Carr is a guy we never name, and the Saints brought in Josh Huff over the offseason to kind of compete for a special teams role. So this is, I mean, we're probably looking at nine guys fighting for spots right now.
Yeah, very deep position. And like we said earlier, this roster is pretty deep throughout every position group. Now let's talk about maybe a backup that could be the guy behind Drew Brees or could be filling a special teams role. And that's Taysom Hill. Do you think he has the ability to step in and be our backup? Or is that more a Tom Savage? Because I heard Taysom Hill was getting some meaningful snaps with the twos.
If it's up to me, and I understand, you know, I've only seen three OTA practices, and we're just going into minicamp. Barring a horrible, and I mean absolutely horrific, preseason, you know, showing, or, you know, knock on wood, he doesn't get injured. Barring those two things taking place, Taysom Hill is the guy. He is the heir apparent as of today. Now, maybe next year the Saints draft the quarterback and all of that goes away. But as of right now, Taysom Hill is the number two quarterback, and Tom Savage will be lucky if the Saints will keep three quarterbacks in order to keep him on the roster. But it's Taysom Hill's job to lose, and I don't even think it's possible that he loses it at this point. He looks really good in practice. He looks confident, has a command. You can see the athleticism once he breaks the pocket and he has to scramble for it. And most importantly, something that I think was a telltale sign was the idea that Taysom Hill is the holder on field goals. And I don't think they want to even create that chemistry in order to say later on they're going to cut him and get rid of him. I don't think they start that process now if that's a guy that they're not going to keep. To me, in my opinion, Taysom Hill is the number two quarterback, and Tom Savage has to now fight with JT Barrett to see who will be the number three guy, or maybe even, you know, that redshirt year the Saints like to do to some of the pick, draft picks or guys they want to stash. Might get the redshirt year. Tom Savage will be lucky if that's him.
Last Saints question before we get to some NBA talk, and that is, what were your thoughts on the draft? I saw a lot of people nationally graded this draft pretty poorly. I saw even some local guys scratch their head when they saw some picks. But then I've heard some opinions from people saying, look at this roster. It's deep. There's lots of depth. There's lots of talent. So they are able to take some chances on some guys. Should we still have faith in Jeff Ireland? Is this a class that, you know, 5 years down the road, we say, man, that was one of the better classes in Saints history?
I think so. Now, I think the problem is twofold. One is what happened last season with the draft. I think it kind of put everybody's expectations on a different level. But what the Saints did last year is unprecedented. We're talking about just about every draft pick they made not only hit, but contributed in a major way. So I think that kind of threw everybody off. But the blessing in that was the idea that it left the Saints with not too many holes to fill on their roster. So we're talking about a small mixture of veterans, those rookies going into their second year, making the jump and possibly improving. So this draft was all about two things. It was one, getting a position that is an absolute must for the Saints. They can no longer neglect a defensive end opposite Cam Jordan. And that's why they made the move for Marcus Davenport. He was the missing link in their eyes. They needed a guy that could rush the passer. He was one of the better pass rushers in there. And from what I understand, they tried to go after Bradley Chubb, but to move up to get him was just a little too much. So Marcus Davenport was a good fallback option for them. And the second thing that they did was they drafted for depth. they now have depth at these positions that we thought that, you know, were basically solidified. You know, again, Cameron Moore is filling in for Marcus Williams. So if Marcus Williams goes down, they believe they have a Marcus Williams clone with him. Natrell Jameson, another defensive back that they're kind of, you know, trying to stash away and, you know, make him play the slot position. And this is not counting the guys that they have coming back from last year. So I think they had the luxury of being able to gamble on guys to see what they can do. And, of course, Will Clapp is a guy that can play three positions along the offensive line. So I don't think you lose anything with that. The only position they didn't address properly, in my opinion, in the draft was tight end. And, of course, you know, they're able to always find those undrafted free agent gems. And I think they may have one with Deion Yelder.
Yeah, you have to have faith in the Saints scouting department until they show you not to. Because this is a new department from what we had in those years where we had a lot of, you know, 7-9 seasons. So you have to have faith in Jeff Ireland. I still have trust in him. Brian, I'm sure you do as well. But let's get into some NBA talk. As you saw the Cavs get swept in the NBA Finals, and I've seen this question asked a lot nationally, so I want to get the local guy's perspective. For LeBron's legacy, and I'm going to let Justin chime in too because I know Justin's a big LeBron fan. What does this do?
Wrong.
What does this do for LeBron's legacy getting swept in the finals?
That's a good question. I'm sorry. You can answer it first.
Oh, my apologies. Go first, my brother. I got plenty of time.
Okay. Well, honestly, I don't think it hurts his legacy at all. I really think that this finals really doesn't even matter because we've seen the team that he had. I'm not making any excuses for him, but he wasn't really even supposed to be in the finals. I mean, we've seen the roster that he had, and I think that his legacy only got better by making it to the finals. So I don't think that this sweep hurts his legacy at all, to be honest. I think making it to the finals actually helped his legacy. Because, I mean, he really carried this team on his back. I mean, he beat the Celtics at home, which wasn't supposed to happen. He beat the Raptors. That was not supposed to happen. The only series that he was supposed to win was the Indiana Pacers series. And other than that, I don't think this sweep hurt his legacy at all.
I'm partial to agree with you on that. Simply because I think, in my opinion, LeBron's legacy is already kind of cemented, but that's from my point of view. I'm a little bit older than you guys probably are, so I'm more of a Jordan being the greatest of all time type of person. So to me, LeBron's legacy didn't take a hit because I will always view him as second best. And because of that, I don't think it took a hit. Now, to most in a national, you know, on a national perspective, it's going to take a hit because you can't get swept twice in the playoffs and be Michael Jordan or be greater than Michael Jordan. It can't happen that way. You have to actually, you know, either do something to surpass Jordan or you have to do something that Jordan can never do. An example of that would have been LeBron may not ever get to 7 rings. So for you to pass Jordan, less likely to happen. However, if you would have to have beaten the Golden State Warriors as presently constructed with the roster you have, well, now you have a legit argument for saying I'm the best ever because nobody could have done what I just did. And I think that's the problem with LeBron getting swept. I think winning a game would have kind of made him even greater in people's eyes because, as stated, you can't really expect him to beat the Golden State Warriors with the team that he had. But losing and getting swept is a different story. So I think when it comes to LeBron, people are going to feel the way that they feel about him. But I don't think there's anything wrong with ever being second best to Michael Jordan.
Honestly, that game 4 where he got swept, I think it actually hurt his legacy because I know the game was out of hand, but if this was Kobe or Jordan, you could probably speak for Jordan, but I've seen Kobe play. I don't think I've ever seen Kobe really give up in any game. And it just looked like, I mean, like in the fourth quarter, like normally like this whole playoff series or in the finals, LeBron James has played the whole game. When the fourth quarter came, he was sitting out and he checked out like with four. He came back in the game with like eight minutes in the fourth quarter and then checked back out with 4 minutes left. I don't think Kobe Bryant would have done that. And that's why I still put Kobe over LeBron James, because you always see Kobe's best, like no matter what the score is, he's going to always go hard. And LeBron James, he kind of picks and chooses picks and chooses when he goes hard. And to start the game, I didn't see him going hard. I feel like he knew that he was going home. This was their last game. And that's why I still pick Kobe over LeBron James, and also because he has five rings. And I know people say that rings don't really matter. I know he leads all playoff scorers. He's the number one playoff scorer. He leads them in minutes. But at the end of the day, it's still about rings. He had teams in the past to earn rings, but he didn't get it done. And I still think that Kobe is still over LeBron James. That's just my opinion. It's still Jordan, Kobe, and then LeBron James. That's just where I stand at with that.
Here's what I say to combat that just a little bit, and I know you guys are going to want to move on in a sec. Here's what I say to combat that. It's just the idea of, do I agree with you in the idea that it looked like LeBron maybe checked out, you know, he tapped out a little bit early? Yes, it does. I can't dispute that. And, I mean, that's pretty much the national perspective right now, that he kind of looked like he was disinterested, you know, that he kind of thought the game was over, so why go out there and play hard? I get that. But whenever people mention Kobe and said that, well, he's never quit, that's not necessarily true. Kobe quit against the Phoenix Suns. And it's the idea that a lot of people, I think it was the second year in a row that he saw the Phoenix Suns, and this was the year that Steve Nash won MVP back-to-back. And I believe it was the second time around in which Kobe played the Phoenix Suns. The year before, most of the national media got on Kobe's case because they said he shot the ball too much. So the very next time he played the Phoenix Suns in the playoffs, I believe the series, they were down, I want to say they were down 3-2. And that final game in the series, Kobe just decided he wasn't going to shoot the ball at all. I believe that game he might have went like 4-for-13, if I'm not mistaken. But whatever it was, he definitely went out, you know, kind of LeBron James-esque in the idea that he was like, oh, you think I shoot the ball too much? Fine, I'm just not going to shoot at all. I'm going to pass the ball all day long because that's what you guys think it's going to take for us to win. The very next year, the Lakers got in Paul Gasol. So I think that's a little bit of a misconstrued, you know, viewpoint on Kobe never quitting. He's done it before.
But, like, also, I think, like, he was trying to prove a point on that one. You know what I mean?
Oh, I agree with you, but proving a point, not proving a point, I can't give him the benefit of doubt saying he always went hard if you took that stand. Allen Iverson is a guy that I can say always went hard. I don't know if I can say that about Kobe Bryant.
Well, so let me ask another question about LeBron. Brian Windhorst came out and said that he broke his hand in game one. But, you know, LeBron still put up some numbers games two, three, and four. Do y'all really believe that he broke his hand, or do you think that's kind of just a story?
I seen an Instagram pic, and his hand did look pretty swollen. So I applaud him for playing through, you know, all four games, because his hand was swollen. I don't know if it was broken, but his hand did look pretty bad in that picture they had on the internet. So I don't know if that story is true, but his hand did look pretty bad. I think it is true. Yeah, yes. I believe the story is true.
Yes, I believe.
I don't want to put it all on LeBron James. I just think like the whole team, like the team as a whole, they all just checked out in that game. Like the defense, but Charles and Lyndon, like they've been saying this all season that the defense is horrible, and they showed their true colors in game four because there was no defense being played at all. I mean, that was horrible, to be honest. That game four, it was really all Warriors. Yeah, I didn't see any effort from the Cavaliers at all. It's like they knew that they were going home that night.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
That's really all I have to say about that. Yeah. There's nothing to say about, like, there's no effort at all.
Brian, what were your thoughts on this? Do you think that he actually broke his hand?
Yeah, I have to agree. I think there was something up with his hand. Now, whether or not he totally, you know, it was a complete break, maybe a fracture, maybe, you know, he hit it and just, you know, it was a bone contusion to where it's just deeply bruised. I'm not sure, but I think there's some validity to it. The problem that I have with it is that I got mad he punched the whiteboard. I would have been happy if I would have heard he punched Jared Smith in the face. I mean, at least I would have understood why he got so frustrated, because at that point, you could see it all on his face that all the emotion was drained from him from the incompetence that surrounded him. The idea that George Hill misses the free throw. The idea that Jared Smith, you know, has a boneheaded play. And the idea that Tyronn Lue understood that they had timeouts and didn't take one. All of that just compiled, just made me think that maybe LeBron should have punched somebody in the face instead. I'm not advocating violence. I'm only doing it tongue-in-cheek. But it's the idea that why punch a whiteboard, a fire hydrant, you know, a locker, whatever have you. I don't think you should try that one. If you're going to get that mad, then just, you know, swing on somebody that you feel like was worthy of it. That's all I'm saying. LeBron, you know, the rest of the team quitting, I think they took their role from LeBron, and I honestly just think they were outmanned to begin with. The only person LeBron James can honestly say he was able to count on the entire series was Kevin Love. And, you know, I think luckily for him that Kevin Love was even there, because if not, it would have been even uglier.
Right.
So here's my look. Let's move on from the Cavs. We'll come back to them because I obviously have to ask the biggest question with them. But with the Warriors, how much longer can the Warriors sustain winning like this and keep this core together? You know, I think they're going to be going into their third or fourth year paying the luxury tax, and it only continues to increase with paying more guys money. And then I think it like quadruples this year. Brian, how long do you think they can keep this together?
I think as long as they can keep Klay Thompson together. Now, as long as Klay Thompson is there, and I think he's the next up after KD, because KD's going to get his. And I recently saw reports that Trevor Ariza wants to go there. And I kind of think you'll see some of the guys start to tail off a bit. I think David West, you may see him retire. I think Andre Iguodala, you might see him retire. So I think you'll see a guy like maybe Trevor Ariza sneak over there. Maybe some of these other free agents, maybe a Jamal Crawford will sneak there. So I think they can keep it going because they can keep that bench being just as deep with shooters. I think as long as Klay Thompson decides he wants to, you know, remain a member of the Warriors, and he's indicated that he's willing to take less to do so, I think that's, as long as he can stay there, they'll be just fine. I think they have at least another year or two of a run until the NBA figures them out. And once that happens, I think it's pretty much, you know, it's going to be a dogfight from that point on, but they'll still be in contention every year. Houston gave them all they could handle this year outside of Chris Paul getting hurt. And I think they actually had a really legit chance of knocking Golden State off if Chris Paul doesn't, you know, suffer that hamstring injury. But I think they're about a year or two away from the NBA actually catching on how to out-warrior, not out-warrior the Warriors, how to combat what the Warriors do. And I think it's just the old school method of you got to play bully ball with them. And I think not just bully ball, but maybe a little cat and mouse. Maybe if the Pelicans, for instance, were able to sign a Paul George and bring back Boogie Cousins, then you can play cat and mouse with them in the idea that you can play a little big ball and a little small ball and mix it up on them instead of just trying to out-warrior the Warriors or trying to, you know, specifically play bully ball when they're just running past you all game. I think if you can play cat and mouse, you may be able to catch up with them.
That's an interesting take because, you know, the Pelicans, I think they did bring this roster together to combat the Warriors and give them something different because it seems like everyone wants to try to out-warrior the Warriors. And to me, it doesn't always work because it hasn't worked in the past. You know, Cleveland did win that one year, but besides that, the Warriors are just a juggernaut. You know, one of the best teams ever assembled. And like you said, I think a little bully ball might be something that they're not used to. You look at the Warriors starting five, and if you have a Boogie and AD, and let's say you do get a guy like Paul George out there, the Warriors are going to be forced to play a guy like JaVale McGee or even a Zaza, someone that can handle the body of DeMarcus Cousins. But, you know, talking about the Warriors and themselves, I kind of agree with you. You know, who wants to get paid more than what, you know, the Warriors are willing to give up? And you were talking about Klay Thompson. I think Draymond Green in 2 years, his contract's up, is a guy that I see is probably leaving, looking to get a bigger payday.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. The only thing that I think is going to happen with Draymond, and I mean, I wish him all the best if he can, you know, cash in on a Supermax deal, is I'm not necessarily sure, unless Draymond goes to a team that's built and constructed much like the Warriors are, I'm not sure he's that effective in every system. And I know the NBA is going to that more pace and space type of offense, and everybody's trying to play fast, and they're trying to duplicate what the Warriors are doing, but I think the reason why the Warriors work so well is because you have now three of the greatest shooters we've probably ever seen in NBA history on the same team, and then Draymond kind of fills in the blank, every, you know, in the meantime. So I don't think everybody can do that. The Pelicans, for instance, if we want to use a team like that, I don't think the Pelicans could use Draymond and all of a sudden it works because they don't have the shooters that Golden State does. If you put Draymond in Milwaukee, I don't think it works. So I think it's going to be a team that has to play ball almost exactly like what the Warriors play if for Draymond to be effective if he chooses to leave. And I think, like you, I think it's a very big possibility in 2 years we could see him walk away for a Supermax deal. But I think whoever's buying Draymond is buying fool's gold.
Well, let's ask a question about another guy leaving. And a lot of people are saying that he's gone. Is LeBron gone? Because I saw, I think it was Cowherd, make the point that there's still a good chance he comes back. But we talk a lot about his legacy, and I think LeBron plays so much into that that he buys into it himself. And winning rings is very important. Having that 3-8 record in the or 3-6 record in the NBA Finals doesn't do him any good. So is LeBron gone? Justin, I'll go to you first.
That's a good question. And that conversation comes up around, I've been around a lot of people, and that's a hot topic right now is where's he going? I just think it depends on what he wants. I mean, if he wants to win his best to go to Houston, if he wants money, go to L.A. or stay in Cleveland. But I just think it's whatever he wants, really. That's where I'm at on that. I think his best picks are Houston and L.A. right now.
Interesting. Brian, what are your opinions on it?
I think he's gone. And I think the reason why he's gone is simply because I don't think the Cleveland Cavaliers can make the moves necessary to get him the help that he's required. And I think that's the biggest problem with it. I don't think there's any move that they can make to possibly get like a Chris Paul or somebody like that to kind of join him in Cleveland. And because you can't get that extra piece, I don't think LeBron can stay there. Now, do I think it'd be beneficial if he stayed in the East instead of going West? Absolutely. I think that's an easier track if he goes East. I mean, you're having a hard time beating the Warriors when it comes to the NBA Finals. Well, imagine having to go through the Western Conference and still maybe having to play the Golden State Warriors before you can even reach the NBA Finals. I think that becomes a little bit of a tougher thing to do, but it wouldn't shock me if he went West. I think the only reason he goes West is if he can truly team up with guys and maybe make that happen in L.A. or in Houston. And I think Houston is a worse fit than L.A. I think L.A., he maybe can get a Chris Paul to, you know, jump ship and go to L.A., maybe even team up with a Paul George. But I don't think two of those guys or enough to beat the Golden State Warriors. I think they need to at least have three of them and see what they can do from there. And I think with Houston, it's just a bad fit because it's too many guys that are ball dominant. LeBron needs the ball to be LeBron. Chris Paul needs the ball to be Chris Paul, and James Harden needs the ball to be James Harden. So I think that's too many pieces that need the ball. Not really sure how that works out. But I did see something today that was very interesting. I did see a scenario in which Carmelo gets bought out, Chris Paul, LeBron, they sign deals, and Paul George gets a sign and trade, and he goes to the L.A. Lakers, and those four guys are now in L.A. That would be surprising, but I'd love to see it.
Now, here's something that's been floating around, and, I saw that Schmidt posted it. AD had a little follow of LeBron the other night and then liked LeBron photoshopped in a Pelicans jersey. I'm not sure how realistic it is. But when you're looking at teams that are best suited to make that run at the Warriors, besides the 76ers, or even if you try to go to Boston, I see the Pelicans as being a very viable option.
I think this goes back to what Justin said. It's the idea LeBron has to ask himself what means more to him. If the money means more to you, you can go to New York, you can go to L.A., either L.A. team, if that's what matters to you most. But if winning is the true factor and you really want a team that can compete with Golden State, the Pelicans are the best choice. And I understand that the Rockets are there and they were, as I stated earlier, they were, a game or two away from actually eliminating the Warriors. But I just think in Houston, it's a bad fit as far as, the ball dominance thing. I think the Pelicans took a game from Golden State and they didn't even have Boogie Cousins. So imagine if you add a Boogie Cousins and a LeBron James with Nikola Mirotic and Anthony Davis and maybe bringing back a Rajon Rondo with Drew Holiday. I think for the Pelicans, it all depends on what you have to give up to get LeBron. If you can just go into the luxury tax and sign him, so be it. If you have to do a sign and trade, that gets a little bit more tricky. And I think that is the possibility that the Pelicans have to, kind of brace themselves for. Because LeBron may say yes, but what if that costs you Drew Holiday and, he was one of your better defenders? Do you still make that move, considering that Drew Holiday is a lot younger? He's on a cheaper contract. So, and of course, Anthony Davis within the next year or two is going to be looking at that Supermax. It could get sticky when it comes to that. So I think it all depends on what matters to LeBron and how do you actually acquire him. But I'd love to see it.
Do you see LeBron even giving New Orleans a look? Because I don't think it's as much. You don't worry about the money. You don't worry about the sign and trade until you can get him to commit to New Orleans. Does he even give New Orleans a look? Does he come down and visit?
I don't think so. I would love for him to even be on the list of teams. I would love for it to leak out outside of Shannon Sharp, who I think was trolling at the time. But I would love for it to leak out that LeBron is even remotely interested in joining the Pelicans, because I'd love to see the national perspective on that, because it just makes sense. I mean, I would love to see him give it a shot, but I did see reports that came out recently that Greg Popovich is going to try to get a conversation with LeBron. And I know how much LeBron loves and respects Greg Popovich. I think San Antonio, if they can get a conversation and if they can sell Kawhi on, you know, coming back and being happy, LeBron and Kawhi are a formidable opponent, and they could definitely give Golden State a run for their money. So I think he gets the best of both worlds. He gets one of the best coaches in the NBA. He gets, you know, his money, and, you know, he gets to team up with some superstars and Kawhi Leonard and of course, LaMarcus Aldridge as well.
Well, man, looking at San Antonio, though, Kawhi and LeBron playing the same position, you know, neither of them are really known for the three-point shooting. Is there enough shooting around that?
No. And, of course, you don't want to keep a young guy like, you know, Dejounte Murray on the sidelines either. So I don't think there's enough shooting. But I think sometimes, you know, you kind of do, you know, I guess it's for a football term, you kind of just get the collection of talent that you can, let the chips fall where they may. And I think that would be the situation in San Antonio. Of course, you know, LeBron can always bring in guys with them. You know, they'll be able to find some spot-up shooters and stuff like that. But do they have enough shooting? Absolutely not. But I think that if LeBron goes there, it makes San Antonio even more of an attractive destination, and they may be able to get somebody like maybe a J.J. Redick, who may say, you know what, I'll take a low deal or the mid-level exception and say I'll go there and play because they have a chance to win a title.
Well, I want to talk about another big free agent this summer, but last question about LeBron. If he were to go to a team like the 76ers, Justin, I'll go to you first. Is there enough shooting there? Because I don't think J.J. Redick, I don't think Marco Bellinelli come back if they are able to add a guy like LeBron.
No, not at all. I mean, Ben Simmons, I just don't see LeBron James and Ben Simmons working too. I just don't see that combination working, because, like, Ben Simmons is a pass first. He can't shoot. LeBron James, he needs the ball. He's like, those two players are both ball dominant. And I just think that LeBron James in Philly, it hurts Ben Simmons' growth. So I don't think he should go to Philly at all, because I just don't see it working. There's no shooting. Ben Simmons, he needs the ball. LeBron James needs the ball. And I just think that they need to stay with who they have right now and just keep building, just going forward with Ben Simmons as their main player and Joel Embiid. So I don't think he should go to Philly right now. It just wouldn't work.
Interesting. Brian, what are your thoughts?
No, I totally agree with Justin on that one. I think Philly's a bad fit in general. And it's exactly what you said. I think Marco Bellinelli and J.J. Redick, if you get LeBron, they're gone. I think it also stunts Joel Embiid's his progress, because he seems to be a guy that craves that spotlight and that attention, and he seems to be a guy that kind of likes the way things are. I'm not necessarily sure if he's willing to open his arms and just welcome LeBron and say, come on in, because the problem with playing with LeBron is always, if he wins, it's all LeBron. And if he loses, it's you're not good enough to help him win. So I don't think Joel Embiid wants to kind of deal with that type of, you know, situation, even though I think if he goes to Philly, they'd probably be the favorites to come out of the East. I'm just a little cautious on that. That's all. I don't necessarily know if it's a great fit. So I can definitely see him, you know, maybe the guys there saying, maybe not. We'll keep what we had and try it all again.
Interesting. Well, hearing that from both y'all, you know, and personally, I think even if he went to Philly, I still think Boston, fully healthy, would be the winners in the East, because I think Boston has the only opportunity besides a Houston to defeat the Warriors in a 7-game series. But let's get into another guy that's going to be hitting free agency this summer, and that's Paul George. And specifically with the Pelicans, Brian, would Paul George fit New Orleans? Is that something that you hope, you know, Paul George takes a look at New Orleans?
I think he's the more realistic possibility. He fits a need, absolutely, because the Pelicans haven't had a small forward since their days of being the Hornets. And it just seems as if he'd be that key piece that they need. They'd also be able to bring back Boogie Cousins if they get Paul George. So I think that's a great thing that could take place. And if need be, with the sign-and-trade for Paul George, you get rid of a lot of dead weight that you don't need. You get rid of a Solomon Hill, maybe an Etuan Moore, and Alexi Ajinsa to make that contract work. So you get rid of those three guys who you definitely don't need. You bring in a Paul George, and maybe you add Rondo for the mid-level exception. And if you're lucky, you can get a low shooter, like maybe a Jamal Crawford on the bi-level exception. And you have a nice little core to go, because you have Nikola Mirotic, who can shoot from outside. Paul George can shoot from outside. Jrue Holiday can work in space with his mid-range game. And, of course, there's nobody like Anthony Davis in the NBA other than Anthony Davis. So I think it works out very well. And it buys you time for Boogie to come back. So I think if that takes place, then, I mean, the Pelicans are definitely going to be one of the front runners in the West.
And you probably have the best defensive team in the league. If Drew can, you know, be first team all defense again, you're looking at the potential to have three guys first team all defense.
Agreed. And especially when you think about the idea that the Pelicans' problem as far as facing a team like Golden State or maybe even a Houston, they just didn't have anybody that could absolutely guard Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant right now is the problem in the Western Conference because guys like Drew Holiday are good enough to get into body and defend him, but he's just not tall enough to defend Kevin Durant. And the same thing when you look at, you know, what Houston is doing. You know, they have guys who, you know, shoot from range. So it's the idea that you just don't have the height to match them right now, but you definitely have the skill set to match them. So if you can just get somebody who can guard a Kevin Durant, you're fine. And I think that's the X factor.
Well, I would love to see Paul George. And to be honest, I wouldn't be upset if they had to trade Nico and a sign and trade to give some value. And, of course, you're going to be throwing a first-round pick in there because Oklahoma City is going to try to get as much value out of that as they can. But if they were to get Paul George, and let's say they lose a guy like Nico, let's say they lose a guy like Etwan Moore, and they clear some space off, they bring Rondo back. What are we looking at in this Pelicans team? Are they a front runner? Are they a contender? Could they beat this Golden State team?
Golden State, as we stated, what they can't do is they can't match up with Anthony Davis. They have nobody on their team that can. Kevin Durant can try to guard him because of the height, but he can't match Anthony Davis when Anthony Davis is being physical. And I think, the beauty of having guys like Anthony Davis, like a Paul George, you know, Boogie comes back and he's healthy and you're able to keep a Drew Holiday, is the idea that they make Golden State have to work on defense. And that's what Golden State doesn't do very much of. If you can get physical with them and wear them down, then it hurts them offensively because, yes, they're going to try to run, but their legs are going to be dead. And I think the Pelicans can kind of, you know, play pace and space with them for a stretch as well. So I think the Pelicans have the ability to match Golden State. Can they beat them? I mean, we'll have to find out a seven-game series. But I think they have the ability to get there and match them, and it won't be a 5-1 series anymore. This will be like a seven-game series, and may the best team win that seventh game.
Yeah, I think banging inside, I think that out-muscling a team is something New Orleans can do. They can bully teams. Like, you know, AD bullied Valanciunas, not Valanciunas, Yusuf Nurkic in that Portland series. I would be ecstatic to see what would happen if you were to add a Paul George and to force teams play to your strengths. You haven't seen, you know, New Orleans be able to make teams play or switch their rosters up to combat what New Orleans was doing. To see basketball come back in the city, I'm sure you saw it, Brian, where New Orleans was, I think, the second highest market for ESPN games. New Orleans is getting a lot of basketball excitement. I know I tweeted it out for Bayou Boogaloo. I saw a lot more Pelicans gear than I had ever seen at that event, or really any event around the city. So for the last question I want to ask, for basketball itself, for this Pelicans team, what's the excitement like around the city, the anticipation for next year, and how popular is basketball getting in New Orleans?
I think that's a great question, and especially because what I've noticed thus far from being on, you know, the radio is the idea that we can talk Saints all day long, and of course everybody loves their Saints here in New Orleans, but what I've noticed is that we get a lot more phone calls than you would expect and a lot more chatter on Pelicans than what people are expecting. So I think basketball is definitely growing in New Orleans. I think having a fun, exciting style of basketball, the way Alvin Gentry wants to play, that pace and space, get up and down the court, that exciting brand of basketball helps. Anthony Davis, of course, helps. And the idea that the Pelicans are winning definitely helps because now you have something that you can sell to the fans. Now if Boogie Cousins comes back or whomever they bring in free agency, now you can sell to the fans, hey, look, we beat Golden State once already. We swept Portland. We were exciting. So now we just need you guys to show up. And if you went to a Pelicans playoff game, you already know the fans not only are there, but they show up. They give you that college, that exciting atmosphere type of thing inside the Smoothie King Center. And I think basketball moving forward is in great hands as long as Anthony Davis is still standing and as long as the Pelicans can add to what they did, keep building. Now, if they win, will they win 55 games next year? Nobody knows. But if you can just still be in contention, be a playoff team, be a team that's on the verge of, you know, kind of making that jump. As long as the fans believe that there's a reason to show up, they'll show up. The minute that the Pelicans start to neglect themselves and decide that, you know what, hey, you know, we made it to the playoffs last year, we don't need to do anything else. If they fooled themselves into thinking that, they'll lose the fans as fast as they gained them.
Interesting. Well, Brian, I want to thank you for coming on. You're always welcome to come join us, and appreciate all your knowledge you dropped. Before you go, where can people find some of your stuff at, and where can they find you out in social media?
I am on ESPN New Orleans. That is 100.3 FM. The name of the show is The Sports Hangover. We're 12 to 3, Monday through Friday. Of course, that's Central Time for all you guys that are listening on the East Coast and on the West Coast. So just, you know, tune us in. We're there. And, of course, I can be found on Twitter all times at Brian TNR. That's BryanTNR. Giving my hot takes, cupcakes, and anything else you guys want to get.
Well, you know, once again, want to thank Brian for joining us. And like I said, you're welcome anytime, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
So much for having you guys.
Just want to thank Brian again for coming on, providing some great Saints insight as mini camp starts tomorrow. It's open to the public. Let me pull up the information on that. While I'm doing that, Justin, where can people find you at on social media?
You guys can find me on Facebook, Justin Baptiste. You guys can find me on Twitter, Justin Baptiste 22. You guys can find me on Instagram, Justin Baptiste 22. Also on Snapchat, Justin Baptiste 22. And you guys can also find me on tradesandlays.com, where I write about the NBA. And also on inthefrontrow.com, where I write about the NBA. Yeah, that's where you guys can find me out. Find me.
Justin, are you going to be doing any NBA draft coverage?
I'm still thinking about it, but I probably am, because I watch the NBA all the time. It's going to be hard to keep quiet during the NBA draft, so I probably will be writing about it. So you guys just keep on the lookout for that. Just keep looking out for that. But I probably will write about it, most likely.
Well, y'all look out for Justin's stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably going to have some stuff going into the offseason. It's a very important offseason for the NBA. It's some big-name guys, even some mid guys, you know, mid-level talent guys can add a lot to a roster, and you never know. Maybe a team can go in next year and defeat the Warriors by adding some key pieces. But to get back to minicamp, it's Tuesday through Thursday, June 12th through June 14th. It is open to the public, weather permitting, from 11 a.m. to 1:20 p.m. I know they're going to be doing autographs after. So if you want to go take pictures to get some autographs with some of your favorite Saints players, go and check that out. Look at the position battles. Look at that backup quarterback position. Look at some of the wide receiver guys. And look at the defensive backfield. I think there's a lot of great position battles to watch out for. And if you see us out there, come say hello. I know Brian's going to be out there, so I'm sure he would love if y'all went and chit-chatted with him for a little bit. And he gave y'all his Twitter. He is always on there, and he responds to fans, has a lot of great feedback. But before we go, you can follow Primetime on Twitter, at PrimetimePodBWT. Give us a follow. We have all of our content up there. We have an interview coming out this week with Cardell Thomas, the big name in the LSU recruiting class for 2019. He talked about some of his favorite things outside of football, and also this class going in, as he's doing a lot of work. And, you know, this week, LSU got a big commit from a cornerback down in Houston. And I know Josh Lemoine, a previous guest, has put some stuff out about him. So go check out what Josh has been putting out. But also, if you haven't done so yet, go to iTunes, keyword, Bros Who Think, no spaces in that. Give us a subscribe, follow us, and rate and review us. That helps us bring great content to y'all every week, and allows us to keep doing what we're doing. And we also have a big guest this week, but you're going to have to be on the lookout for that. But for Justin Baptiste, for Brian and Nola East, my name is Charles Reese, your host. Have a great week, and as always, God bless.